The Ricochet Podcast is brought to you in part by
Patriot Mobile. They offer nationwide talk, text, and high-speed data at competitive prices, and they donate up to 5% of your monthly bill to the conservative organization of your choice. To get started, call 1-800-A-PATRIOT or patriotmobile.com/ricochet. You get the same quality service in the latest and greatest devices, the Apple 6, Galaxy S7, for example. You get competitive prices and center-right causes that you believe in. So finally, a mobile phone company that believes what you believe. Patriot Mobile, America's only conservative phone company, was created to fight for conservative causes and defend conservative candidates. So stand with Patriot Mobile and give voice to your conservative values with every call, text, and status update. Call 1-800-A-PATRIOT right now or go to patriotmobile.com/ricochet to sign up. Patriot Mobile, the conservative choice for mobile phone service. Join the conversation.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press.
Hello.
Good Lord, ride all the way. You've got speed, John Glenn.
I think the media is among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met. Good term.
One of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides.
What Boehner is angry with is the American people holding him accountable.
If I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems.
Well, I don't know why that's funny.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Peter Robinson. I'm James Lilacs, and if you're wondering who's Rob Long this week, it's Drew Klavan, and we'll talk to John O'Sullivan. Let's have ourselves a podcast. Welcome, everybody, to this, the Ricochet Podcast, number 332. How do we get that far? Because we have great sponsors. We're brought to you by Away Travel. Your luggage should not cost more than your plane ticket, right? Well, Away Travel's luggage is designed with the highest quality materials, and it's still under $300. And for $20 off that, visit travel.com/ricochet and use the promo code Ricochet during your checkout. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later. And we're brought to you by Casper Mattresses. I slept well last night. Why? Because I'm on a Casper. They revolutionized the mattress industry by cutting out the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passed that savings on to you. And we're brought to you by Tommy John. Tommy John is reinventing men's underwear. What is that like? Well, find out. 20% off your first purchase. Go to TommyJohn.com/ricochet and enter that promo code. Any guesses? Right. Ricochet at the checkout. And of course, we're brought to you by Ricochet itself. Usually this is the point where Rob Long steps in and tells you all the virtues and advantages of membership. But Rob, he might be with us. He might not. I'm going to do what he does. And what he does is sort of at the beginning abashedly asks for money because, you know, it's his New England upbringing. A Puritan streak in him somehow regards it as just not of his class to do so. But then his avarishness has been born and bred in Hollywood, that comes to the fore and says, yes, we must ask for – well, here's the deal. First of all, if you've been listening to this on Slate's Panoply Network, welcome. And if you're wondering what it is, Ricochet is a center-right conversational place where you can read the comments without feeling as though you've just been stewing in rancid oil. That's because people have skin in the game. People pay to comment, a novel idea, but it's what's kept the site interesting and not just a mosh pit of filth and hate and words. So if you subscribe to Ricochet, and it's cheap, really, you also get the Daily Shot, which is our free email newsletter, and it's a great way to keep tabs on current events and see what's going on. You can contribute to Ricochet. You can read the member feed. You can read all the podcasts. It's great. Ricochet.com. Rob would beg you. I'm telling you, it's something you should do. Be one of the 1,500 people and make sure that Ricochet is with us in the future. Speaking of Rob, we won't, because Drew Klavan is with us, with Peter Robinson as well. Gentlemen, another fascinating week. What bopped out of the mix to you like a silvery carp and caught your attention?
Well, I've noticed that the Trump transition has now fallen into a very, very specific pattern, a four-step pattern. It's Trump makes a pretty darn good pick for one of his cabinet spots. And then that's step one. Step two, the left goes absolutely insane. You know, the world is going to end. All environmental regulations are gone. Business is going to take over the world. And then the right starts to do this kind of think piece. Yes, but is it conservative? You know, is Are our conservative things being – and then just as you're starting to realize that everything is going actually pretty well, Trump does something, step four, that makes you feel insane. Like he attacks some private citizen on Twitter, or he has a meeting with Al Gore or a meeting with Leonardo DiCaprio to discuss climate change. And you think, oh, my God, we're all going to hell in a handbasket. And then he goes the next day and makes a great appointment again. So it's just this kind of routine that's happening every single day. And I like the fact that it's now become predictable.
The unpredictability has become predictable. Exactly. So as beautifully done, Drew, beautifully analyzed, but on balance, you're still happy, aren't you?
I am deliriously happy especially when I compare myself to the way I thought I was going to feel. I was not. Yes. I did vote for Trump. I did vote for him, but I voted for him not just holding my nose, but biting my tongue. And I was really worried, but I feel that we have dodged a cannonball, you know, not just a bullet, but we've dodged like a missile in not electing Hillary Clinton and not accepting this slow decline into socialism and no growth and this political correct identity politics that was enslaving people's minds. And now who knows what's going to happen? I cannot tell from one statement to the next what Trump believes, what he's going to do, but it's got to be better than what was coming down the pike in the form of Hillary Clinton.
The catastrophes that are rolling out, according to the press, are just delightful to watch.
Exactly.
Because now we have a labor secretary who comes from the hiring part. Because that's wrong. We can't have that. We can't have somebody – I mean, on the front page of our paper today, I think it was fast food executive, which says it all, doesn't it? An evil, cackling man who wants the obesity generation to just, you know, expand. Right. He has this quote out there that I love about Hardee's. Is it Hardee's or it's Hardee's advertising, where he says that I happen to like beautiful women in bikinis eating hamburgers. I think it's a very American thing. To which all the bien passant on the left just had their brains, the aneurysm just ran through them like a lightning bolt because they couldn't believe that somebody was saying something that base,
normal.
That normal. That's the thing. And you want the left to look at these things and lose their bleep. You want them to say that they regard a statement like that as the worst thing that you can possibly say. Keep it up. Keep it up, guys.
I have fallen hard for Scott Pruitt, whom Donald Trump has named to head the Environmental Protection Agency and who was causing liberal heads to explode all over Washington. And here's why I've fallen for him. I've now watched him on television a couple of times. I've Googled him, read up on him, and so forth. And here is what you need to know about Scott Pruitt. One, he is really articulate. He will be able to make his case. Two, he doesn't argue the environment. He argues the Constitution of the United States. He's not going to be one of the he's not actually a climate denier. He's on record as saying he thinks that the climate is warming and we may have to do something about that and so forth. But what he does is say what the EPA has been doing for lo these years now is unconstitutional and unlawful. And all the liberals say, no, that's not the point. The point is – no, that is the point. Do we live in a nation of laws or do we not? And if we do, then no arm of the federal government for any reason may become illegal and extra constitutional. Oh my goodness, is that potent. It's simply not an argument they're willing to cope with. They don't want to hear it. And really, it's irrefutable. He is arguing the law. Wonderful.
When we talk about fake news, I think that the climate crisis is the greatest fake news out there. And the EPA, when you think back on it, after Obamacare, Obama has accomplished nothing. He's accomplished nothing through congressional, legal, constitutional means. But what he has done is he's created this shadow government through regulation, and he has tried to give the EPA power to name your sink a waterway. I mean, if I fill up my sink to shave,
right,
the EPA comes in and declares it a waterway.
It's a wetland.
It's a wetland, exactly. And they have jurisdiction over it.
Hold on a second, but that's only if a goose going overhead glanced down and saw the glint of water. So if you then paint over your sky, you know, your the window in the hole of your roof, If you do that so that the goose cannot look down through the skylight, you have committed an act of ecological despoilation that will get your house taken away from you once the fines go. So go on.
Hey, well, even Obama's own courts, even the federal courts have stopped them from doing some of this stuff. And to have a guy at the – I mean, I have to be honest with you. If I were president, I would appoint a Muslim terrorist to run the EPA so he would blow up. I mean, I would appoint a guy who was like strapped with bombs to just go in and blow the place to pieces. But this is the second best thing, to have a guy who actually wants them to adhere to the Constitution and not, you know, this regulatory overreach, which has been the only way Obama could get anything done.
How do you think this man is going to govern? You did say one of those steps is Trump does something that makes us all crazy, makes even good people crazy. And, you know, he has been using the bully pulpit to bully people. And, you know, that not only is it not attractive, it's just wrong. There are going to be moments. I want to give overwhelmingly the news is good. The appointments run from okay to superb, in my judgment. I don't see an appointment that I would consider a bad appointment yet. From okay, which is an improvement over what Hillary would have given us, to superb, which is just unbelievable. Okay. And yet at the same time, wow, there are things going on that just are not right. They're not a large part of what's happening now. But somehow, sooner or later, and I think I'm going to vote for sooner, we, what do I mean we? Now, how do I put this in a non-pompous? I mean the three of us, I mean conservatives, I mean Republican office holders in Congress are going to have to find ways to support this man and his agenda full-throatedly, but at the same time saying, but here I draw a line and here I draw a line. This is going to be very hard. It's going to be Richard Nixon and then some because Trump is a much more compelling figure in public, I think. But with Richard Nixon, you know, conservatives supported him when he was right, but they had to oppose. This will be complicated.
It, you're absolutely right about this. I mean, I think that the one thing I draw hope from is if you go back and look at – if you could put a sort of montage together of Trump's entire campaign, the last third of it is much better than the first two-thirds. I mean, he is actually capable of learning. I mean, he obviously has some personality glitches that are very unnerving, like this thing about not being able to let any insult go. I mean, if you're president of the United States, you got to let a lot of insults go, especially if you're punching down at some individual, you know, who really doesn't have the power to stand up to you. But at the same time, he did learn. And I have taken hope from that, and I've taken hope from the appointment of Reince Priebus as his kind of Congress whisperer. And even Steve Bannon, who makes everybody hysterical, I'm not sure it's a bad thing to have somebody whispering in Trump's ear from the right while Reince Priebus whispers to him from the middle, maybe guiding him along. He is not incapable of learning. And I think that that's an important thing.
Drew, do you have an opinion on Steve Bannon? You must have crossed paths with him. I've shaken his hand a couple times and years ago. I really don't know him.
I'm in a strange position with Steve. I've met him many times, had a couple of long conversations with him. He has never been anything to me but gracious and polite and intelligent and thoughtful. I'm just telling you my personal experience.
Of course.
On the other hand, I work with Ben Shapiro, who has been in this public firefight, and I love Ben, and Ben is an honest man, and I love him, you know, and he's been in this firefight with Bannon over Michelle Field and over a bunch of other things. He called him a bully in the press. And you know, all I can say is I know that Ben is not making that up, that is his experience. So I'm a little bit torn. The one thing I will say is I'm absolutely convinced, even though I feel that he has dangerously winked at certain people on the alt-right who really need to be put back under their rocks, he is not himself an anti-Semite. I'm very confident of that. And he's not himself a bigot or a Nazi or any of the things that the press is trying to tag him with. I do think he's been a little bit loose with those guys and, you know, thinks he can put them back in the box. And I'm always a little bit more worried than that.
Does it worry you that they would be loose with him in the first place, that they would say, well, for this period, these people are useful. We can dispense with them afterwards. But for now, let's Let's push the loudness button on these guys for a while. Does that bother you?
Hell yes, it bothers me. Hell yes, it does bother me.
Yeah. Does it? How do you think that is going to inform what goes on forward? That these were all just simply tools in order to get in and do the right and proper things, or that there actually is no moral, ethical center whatsoever?
No, I
stark contrast, but.
I think that, first of all, I think there are far, far, far fewer of them than the New York Times wants us to believe. I think that, you know, when you go and you investigate their Twitter feeds, each one of them has like 1,500 Twitter names. So there's like 200, you know, they had a big rally in Washington. They got 200 people. I mean, you can get 200 right. people to look at a pet rock in this country. And these are the guys who came out from under the pet rock. So that, you know, I'm sure you can get 200 people. But I think that they are. Outliers. I get nervous when somebody says we're going to use them and then put them back in the box, because those guys are hard to get back in the box. But I do not think that they are a powerful movement. I think that they are really.
No, it's just my question to both of you is does it bother you that that they use? I mean, what does it say about the ethical nature of the administration? And I'm just asking you.
Yeah.
What it reveals.
Well, I think it obviously was a moral mistake. I mean, I don't see any other way to put it. I mean, I listened to this guy, Milo Yiannopoulos, and I've spoken with Milo. I think, you know, I think he's a guy who's making an error. He's the ironic gay guy who says, oh, the alt-right is just messing with the politically correct people. And my message to him is always like, if you are ironically evil, evil wins. You know, evil is stronger than irony. You know, and I think that these guys have got to understand political correctness is a kind of tyranny. You know, it is a terrible thing. It has driven everybody insane. But when you're destroying political correctness, you do not want to destroy moral discourse with it, right? I mean, we want to remain decent people who don't bully one another. And so I understand the instinct to crash it, but I just think this is a reactionary force that needs to be stopped. Does that answer the question?
I mean, yes.
Absolutely. So beautifully that there's nothing else to say. that's why we don't have you on more often, because we're supposed to fill roughly an hour. And when you're on, 10 minutes, we're done.
Concision is my middle name. I'm an attractive middle name.
May I raise, just before we go to John O'Sullivan, you mentioned the desire to be an honorable people. And when we lost John Glenn yesterday, I read the obits, and of course I knew this, and I don't know about James, but Drew and I think both, I was a little boy when he orbited the Earth, and I can still remember my mother. We went to the A&P, we had some groceries. I wasn't even in school yet, but I can remember this, and everybody, the grocery store was hushed, and we had to hurry back to the house to turn on the radio and hear how it all went. And, you know, you look at that man's life. I think it was close to 50 combat missions in World War II, something like 90 combat missions in Korea. And then when he went into space, he was riding a fireball of such size and intensity that after they locked him in, everybody else drove 3 miles away before the launch. And I think it's also – I'm saying this. I want to hear what you two have to say about it. It's also not insignificant that – he married his childhood sweetheart and remained faithful to this woman, Annie Glenn, for 73 years until his death yesterday. And I thought to myself, really, the only way to understand John Glenn is through categories that the politically correct would have us rule out altogether. He was the last knight. He lived up. It's a boy from Ohio who in some way is the fullest flowering of chivalry. Valor, gallantry, fidelity. And the way the country has responded to his death suggests that those ideals are still there. Who knows? Maybe we'll be allowed to speak about them again. Am I over-responding here, James?
Drew? No, not at all. And we'll talk about John Glenn after we've talked to John O'Sullivan. We've got just a raft and a panoply of great Johns here. But I do. I remember when you see the old photograph of the guy going up the gantry and carrying in his hand that little oxygen exchanger unit that they had to have. Those guys had to pack for a trip like that. Nowadays, of course, when we go on a trip, we think we have to pack everything from our cords to our extenders to multiple shavings and all the rest of it, and it's a big pain. And you can never get it into one little thing that you want to put into the bin up above. They want to charge you for that bin, too. Oh, one day, if we actually have to start paying airlines to charge, don't you want to really have something slide in that bin that you're proud for everybody to see? That would be something from Away Travel. That's a company that was started to create the absolutely perfect luggage. And believe me, I got one. They did it. Their approach was simple. You create special objects that are designed to be resilient, resourceful, and essential to the way that you travel today. All the suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate. They're unrivaled in strength and impact resistance. You can really knock them around, but they're still very lightweight. And they have four 360-degree spinner wheels guaranteed for a smooth ride piloting that thing around the airport. So the carry-on sizes are compliant with all major U.S. airlines, and they maximize the amount you can pack. You get a lot of stuff into this guy. Both sizes of the carry-on are able to charge cell phones, tablets, e-readers, and anything that's powered by a USB cord. How cool is that? Lifetime warranty as well. If anything breaks, ever, Away will fix or replace it for you for life. Is that it? No. There's a 100-day trial. And if at any point you decide it's not for you, just return it for a free refund and no questions will be asked. Free shipping, of course, within the continental United States. And it's great as a gift. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's this holiday thing coming up. And if you're wondering what to get somebody, take a look at their battered old suitcase and think, I know what to do here. The gift set. It's packed in a miniature Away suitcase. And it includes travel socks, a gift card, travel-sized shampoo, conditioner, body cleaner, balm, all the things, special edition holiday colors as well. Snow, which of course is white, and asphalt, which is charcoal gray. They're only available for a limited time, so get on it. Now, Away offers two additional sleek and stylish gifts for your travelers to complement their luggage. Incidentally, a passport holder and a luggage tag. They match the suitcases. It's a beautiful 100% baby alpaca travel blanket as well. Where do you start? Where do you go? Go to their website, awaytravel.com. Take a look. $20 off your first suitcase. That's awaytravel.com/ricochet. Use the promo code ricochet during checkout for $20 off. And believe me, this is a gift for somebody or for yourself. It's the best suitcase you are ever going to take through an airport. Now we welcome to the podcast John O'Sullivan, former editor of National Review. And he had that position between William F. Buckley Jr. and Rich Lowry in the years from 1988 to 1997. He's been editor-at-large at NR since then, and in recent years, a senior fellow of the National Review Institute. He's also president of the Danube Institute, a think tank devoted to promoting conservative and classical liberal ideas in Budapest, and a director of the Washington think tank 21st Century Initiatives in Washington, D.C. He's just written a cracking good piece in National Review about the European situation as it pertains to America, and we're happy to have him on to talk about it. John, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. You're here with Drew Klavan and Peter Robinson, and this is James Laddix in Minneapolis, a long ways from France. But France actually is going through something that maybe is not all that different from what the United States is seeing. You wrote a piece for NR about populism and how it's being inaccurately described pertain to what's going on in Europe. And let's start with France. What is happening? We always say, this is it. Finally, they're going to realize their sclerotic rules are choking them. And then, of course, somebody comes in and nothing happens. But could the French situation now actually be the start of something good?
Well, it's certainly the start of something, and something big. whether it's good, we'll have to wait and see. But I don't think it's going to lead, myself and good friends like Michael Walsh disagree. I don't think it's going to lead in the next election to a victory for what would then be for the National Front and for Marine Le Pen. I don't think she'll make the presidency, but she's going to actually have a good performance, and you can't rule it out. I mean, she's going to be against a socialist party which is in very low water, which has had a very bad job, which has shown no ability to revive the ailing French economy, and which has run into all sorts of difficulties, and so much so the president has resigned. But the surprise is that the opposite, the kind of centre-right party, they keep changing their name, but they're now called the Republicans, has chosen not Sarkozy, and not Juppé, the two leaders, but it's chosen this man, François Fillon, who is a Catholic traditionalist on the one hand, and amazing for France. He's a Thatcherite. He believes in free markets and in lack of protectionism and so on. So he's moving against the trend in America, as a matter of fact. He's actually picking up the Thatcherite banner, and astoundingly, he seems to be doing quite well. So there is, you know, you can't. You never know in politics. Things change all the time. But Fion is a man to watch, and I think it's going to be between the battle between him and Marine Le Pen.
John, Peter here. Peter Robinson here.
Yeah, hi, Peter.
On the morning of June 23rd, did you expect Brexit to win?
I thought there was a real possibility, and I thought that for reasons which I think perfectly normal, rational ones, namely that there'd been a steady 40% of the British population for the previous 30 years kept telling the pollsters that they wanted Britain to leave. So you knew that there was this solid phalanx of opinion. It very rarely became a majority once or twice in the polls. It was generally, most of the time it wasn't even a plurality, but it was a very significant number all the time. So I always knew that was possible. And I thought that if they were actually able to get their message out, they would win. But on the other hand, they did get their message out and they did win. But it was a big hill to climb, and all the way they were climbing against a treasury, all the world's establishments piling in saying, this is mad, you can't do it. And so it was a remarkable victory in the end.
And one more before I let Drew Klavan come in. You and I have talked about this a lot over the years, because we first got to know each other when I was a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan and you were writing speeches for Mrs. Thatcher. But it's certainly since the Second World War, it's a kind of observable pattern, or at least it's an arguable pattern, that Britain and the United States in some loose way often seem to move in sync with one another. Brexit gets voted and Donald Trump wins, these two huge unpredictable elections. And now it looks as though the continent of Europe is also somehow in sync. And I what do we make of this? Do we simply have to conclude that we still share a civilization?
I think we can, and we do. But let me claim some prescience here. I sort of noticed around 1986, which is 30 years ago, that all over Europe, there were parties emerging that were taking up issues like mass immigration, opposition to multiculturalism, nervousness about globalism and about the powers going to Brussels European Union. They were taking up these causes, and they were beginning to make serious ground. And over 30 years, they've made very serious ground. Why was that?
Yes.
It was because the leaders of the mainstream conservative parties in particular were not fighting for the causes which millions of their voters believed in passionately.
Right. I'm sorry, I have one more question before I let Drew
okay.
in. But this strikes me as very significant. You noticed the trend 30 years ago, but that they would win three decades later means that they must also have had to appeal to the rising generation. That is to say, I think this is hopeful, but I want to hear what you have to say. 30 years ago, one could have argued that it was the World War II generation that remembered an earlier Britain, or that remembered an earlier France. Those who still remembered what it was like to believe in the vision of France of Charles de Gaulle. But 30 years later, no, you cannot argue that it's simply the last glimmer of anything. It's a rising trend, and whoever was founding these parties or making these arguments 30 years ago has persuaded new generations. This is something living, correct?
It's something living, but I think you've got to separate what's happening in Britain from the other places in this regard. The young people didn't vote in large numbers, but there was a large majority in the young for remaining within the EU. There was a large majority in the people, for older people, in getting out. Now, that was on the day of the election. But if you now look at the polls, the latest poll shows that the people who want to remain are down to 32% of the vote, whereas the leavers are up to 68%. And that's a poll, but it's also reflected in this by-election yesterday, very important one, in which the Tories romp home and in which the second party is UKIP. And the Labour Party wasn't even strongly against, it's not clear on anything, but it's officially supposed to be in favour of Brexit. So you have between two-thirds and three-quarters of the British voters in this by-election saying that they definitely want to leave. And I think it's a game-changer. Everyone is now going to accept the fact that, yes, it's over. Brexit will occur. I mean, there'll be a rearguard action by the people they call the Ramoners, the people who are bitter end Remainers. But I think most people now think it will definitely happen. And it's happened in part, it's now that they've got stronger in part because all of the catastrophes predicted by the Remain campaign simply haven't happened.
You know, John, hey, it's Andrew Clavin. How are you doing?
Hello, Andrew. How are you? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. You mentioned in your piece that all these populist movements, they're being called populist, they're very different from one another in different countries, and some are on the left and some are on the right. But it seems to me the one thing that unites them, that unites this entire movement, of which Trump is only a symptom, I think, certainly not the cause, is a recognition that some terrible failure has taken place. On the left, they always accuse you of xenophobia or racism or whatever, but it seems that all of these movements are noticing that something has gone terribly wrong with the direction we're going. Could you speak for a minute about what you think that is philosophically, not just one issue here and one issue there, but what is it overall that these people are sensing?
Well, it's almost a structural thing, Andrew. If you think about it, over the last 20 to 30 years, the mainstream parties, left and right, have been they're essentially mainstream parties on both sides are fairly liberal. And, of course, they differ about lots of things, mainly about tax cuts and about welfare policy and so on. But there are issues on which they agree about. And they have included being in favor of multiculturalism, accepting mass immigration, devaluing the nation state, handing over more powers to global bodies and international treaties. And millions of their populations, I mean, probably a majority, don't actually like this set of policies. So they kept these policies out of politics. They did so by the simple process of trying not to discuss them at all, or if they did discuss them, making kind of feeble promises which they ignored when they got into power. And the other side didn't attack them for it because they were united there. Well, this has gone on for a long time. And taking issues that people care about out of politics ultimately doesn't work. What you do is you create the grounds in which new political entrepreneurs and parties come into the game and begin to win. And so what you have is a choice here. You have a choice between establishment liberalism, which controls the system most of the time, and I'm not being pejorative here. I mean, a lot of these people are friends of mine. And then you have, on the other hand, you have the populism that emerges when democracy is denied. Now, democracy is the answer to both. If you have democratic government, the acceptance that the majority rules and not simply the courts will take over, or they will be told we can't do this because some international treaty says we can't. But once you have people electing a majority and the majority being able to govern, then populism gradually atrophies, and establishment liberalism has to accept that it can actually correct democracy to the extent of preventing abuse or preventing the assaults on minorities, but it can't actually be the government because the government has to represent the majority. And I don't mean a racial majority or an ethnic majority or a linguistic majority. I mean the majority of people who happen to vote on a given day in an election.
It does seem that there has been this slow erosion of the idea of personal freedom that rose up basically in the 18th century, where bureaucrats and bureaucracies have become the new royalty. It seems that that must be part of what people are revolting against. Certainly in Europe, I know it's true here with – we were talking earlier about the EPA and all these regulatory agencies. But this idea of a government in Brussels that nobody elected that comes and tells you how much salt to put in your chips, I mean, certainly that has got to be morally offensive to a large number of people.
Well, I think that's true. And I'd say that what we've seen is the gradual transfer of power, which people just didn't notice for a long time, from elected accountable bodies like congresses and parliaments to the courts, to bureaucracies which are de facto independent, to global bodies and to international treaties. And so that we not only have a local bureaucratic government, but we have an international or global bureaucratic government, or in the case of the EU, a European bureaucratic government in which, you know, they pass laws. And when you try, when you go to your MP and say, I don't like this law, can't we try to change it? He says, well, we'd like to, of course, but you must understand this is a European business, nothing we can do. And the same thing happens in America, except the congressman says, we'd like to do it. Of course, you're quite right. I agree. But the Supreme Court, unfortunately, has decided this and there's nothing we can do. And people have simply got fed up with this. And because the major parties weren't taking them seriously, they went to other parties, some of which are very respectable, some of which are not at all respectable, most in between.
You know, we were told that the reason that everyone had to subsume their nationalistic impulses into a European project was because nationalism had led in the 20th century to such great catastrophes and tragedies. But surely that can't be the motivating factor now, John, is it? Or is it just simply power now that the transnational elite enjoys?
Well, I never accepted that argument, by the way. The Second World War wasn't caused by nation states. I mean, it was caused by an agreement between two powers, one of which was a transnational collectivist government called the Soviet Union, right. And the other of which was not a nationalist government. It was a racist government, which had a theory that, the Nazis did not believe in nation states. They didn't respect other nation states. They just wanted to run everything themselves on a global racial basis, which was an absurdity, and which, as Orwell pointed out, it just wasn't practical in the modern world, and of course it was defeated. So I don't take that argument seriously. But yes, the answer is that there is a kind of perverse idealism that lies at the root of a lot of this. And a lot of intellectuals have convinced themselves. If you talk to German intellectuals, they will tell you there's no such thing as a nation state. They will say those kind of things. And you know, it's an outdated concept. And indeed, that's partly lies behind the welcome that Mrs. Merkel gave to refugees from Syria, many of whom were refugees not from Syria.
Well, one of the questions that we had at the trivia board at the coffee shop the other day, you got 10% off your order if you could say when Germany was created as a state, and there was all these, you know, 792 BC, all these ancient dates, and my daughter was surprised to learn that Germany was fairly recent, like Italy, which was cobbled together fairly recently. And now Italy itself has two strains, it would seem, the northern and the southern, and we have this five-star party run by a comedian and people who do not seem to be serious sorts that you'd want with the levers of power. Let's talk about what's coming up in Italy. They just had a referendum, which many people – well, you can set it far better than I can. What is the story in Italy, and what's their future look like?
Well, let's be clear, by the way, that in the case of a lot of countries, the nation is a relatively recent arrangement, has brought together several different sub-nations, and that's true for the English as well, of course. I mean, Britain had four constituent nations in it. It's now got three, and it's possible, though I think it's highly unlikely, the Scots will go. So yes, the Italians are one case, but other, you know, a lot of countries which are relatively recent, but that doesn't mean to say that they weren't built out of natural materials. They were, and the Italians here have been among the least, so to speak, integrated of nations. They've been, as you said, first of all, the religious differences between the majority of Catholics in the country and the nationalists because of their attitude to the Vatican. Then, of course, North and South have never really worked together very well. And the answer to that has been for the North to pay large subsidies to keep the South happy. The result of that has been the South has never adapted effectively to modern economic life and been able to stand on its own two feet. I mean, and that's now happening on a major scale. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Europe, what you're seeing is the Brussels Commission treating the whole of Mediterranean Europe as if it's the Mezzogiorno, as if it's a poor part of southern Italy that will have to be given subsidies indefinitely. But that's only because the Brussels has imposed the euro on these countries, though they've accepted it, of course, and the euro has created conditions in which they can never prosper by normal methods, in my view. I mean, in the view of a lot of economists. So if you create circumstances in which however hard people work and however clever they are, they can't ever support themselves, then you're going to have to give them subsidies indefinitely. And that creates bad feeling between the taxpayers in countries which finance the subsidies. So fundamentally, the euro took all the problems of Europe and it aggravated them. It made them much sharper and more difficult for everybody.
Can I ask one last question? I'd like to know about your reaction to Trump. I mean, you were kind of on the Trump train pretty early, were you not? Am I right about that?
Well, I mean, you and others have been kind enough to suggest this, but in fact, I thought he had a chance at all the time, but there were times that I thought he wouldn't, and I think that I was like a lot of people. I thought that it was unlikely that he would in the end make it to the finishing point, and I didn't think so on the day itself. You may be confusing me with my wife, Melissa, who thought he did say all the time. Definitely would win, yeah.
But you're a National Review guy, which has been a pretty strong anti-Trump voice. Were you part of that voice, or did you feel that there was something good about it?
Well, I think it's perfectly right of the magazine to, and its writers like Rich and Jonah and Kevin to state their opposition to someone with whom they disagreed. I mean, you either agree with someone or you don't. They didn't agree with Trump, so they said so. I had a lot of sympathy with some of their views, and when most of the time I was on their side. But I was not on the side of the one or two writers like David, for example, David French, who was a very eloquent voice for never Trumper, even to the point of being willing to see Hillary in, I think, rather than him. And my view was I was an almost never Trumper at points most of the time, but I was always a never Hillary.
Yeah.
And I think the action we've had since the election suggests that those of us who said never Hillary were right. I mean, people could sense, even when they couldn't work it out exactly, that Hillary represented the clamping down of all the worst aspects of American life on a semi-permanent basis.
Yes, I agree. I'm right there. I was a never Hillary person too, but ultimately voted for Trump and feel good about it now.
So, yeah, no, I think people do, actually.
Yeah.
John, Peter here for one last one. Donald Trump. On the one hand, economic policy. On the one hand, he's calling for cutting taxes, rolling back regulations. On the other hand, he's calling for a huge infrastructure spending program and protectionism. On the one hand, he has, by his very election, placed all the forces of political correctness, the universities, the mainstream media, these are in confusion and disarray. On the other hand, he's using tweets to bully people. I thought it was outrageous. Some union official and he got into a spat, and Trump smacked a union official who, as best I could tell, this is yesterday, was simply correcting Trump's numbers on how many jobs had been saved at Kerry. All right. So 100 days after his inauguration, will conservatives be saying to themselves, oh, this is all working out so much better than we had expected? Or will they be saying to themselves, we need to scramble to find our footing and decide how best to oppose this man?
Let me say, first of all, the thing about the union official, I don't care about that. This America, look, America is a country in which anyone can say what they like to the president, and to be fair, therefore, vice versa. I mean, I'm happy to have a rouse between the president and other people. That's fine. You're absolutely right. You don't on a number of issues. He's been very, very good on a number of issues. From my standpoint, not good at all. I'm a free marketeer, and insofar as I believe there may be a role for protection, it seems to me it's a modest one of trying to make it easier for people to transition from an old to a new economy. Okay, fine. There's a third element, though, isn't there, Peter, which is we just don't know what he's going to do next.
Yes.
I mean, he's continually pulling, rabbits out of hats, and sometimes the rabbits aren't exactly frisky. So I'm therefore highly cautious. But I do know this, that he's living within a party system. All the Democrats will be happy to get rid of him. And a lot of Republicans are not mad keen either, though they're growing warmer. So that means he's got to accept that he can only act within certain limits. It seems to me his cabinet picks are by and large very, very good. And that suggests a willingness to look at American politics coldly, work out exactly what is doable, and try to appoint people who can do it. And I'm delighted that Jeff Sessions has got the Attorney General job, and so on and so forth,
yes.
as well as Mad Dog Mattis. So he's got an impressive group of people. He's operating within rational limits. Some of the things he wants to do, he won't be able to. And it's up to us as writers to strengthen those forces which are going to push him in the right direction rather than the wrong one. That, it seems to me, is where we are at the moment.
Voice of reason based on knowledge of history and human nature. John, you know, you're just never going to get anywhere in this world. You've got to be, we need spasms of panic and bleats of hate if we're going to get through here. But you can read Europe Agonisti's National Review online, and you will profit from it. John, thank you for being with us today.
Not at all. Thank you. It's always fun to be with you. Okay, all the best. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I read the piece, the Europe Agonisti's piece last night, and just loved it because he puts his finger on something that I was thinking about as I went to bed, which is rare, and you don't want to do because then you're sitting there and you're churning and you're thinking and you're not going to sleep. My wife will toss and turn because she's got stuff at work that she's thinking about. Here I am unable to sleep because I've got John Sullivan's brilliant analysis of Europe going on in my head. But John wasn't so smart and so good that I couldn't fall asleep after about 40 seconds because I was on a Casper mattress. That's basically it. And you know why you should get one too, don't you? No? Well, let me guide you through the basic points here. If you're just new to the internet and the world and waking up and looking around and wondering, Casper, what? Mattress? What? Selling mattresses online? Yeah, exactly. The mattress industry before Casper forced you, the consumer, to pay notoriously high prices, markups. Casper revolutionized all that by cutting the cost of dealing with the resellers and the showrooms and all that overhead and the air conditioning and the heating. What they saved, they passed to you. Now, Time magazine, taking note of this, named it one of the best inventions of 2015. And it is an award-winning mattress that will not disappoint you. Why? Because it's obsessively engineered. And it's a shockingly fair price, to be honest. Mattresses can cost you over $1,500 if you've shopped recently, but Casper's $500 for a twin, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, $950 for a king. Now, they have this in-house team of engineers. They didn't outsource this thing. No, those guys spent thousands of hours developing the Casper, and it combines this springy latex with supportive memory foam to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. It's got a breathable design, too, that sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. Now, buying a Casper is completely risk-free. Let me use that word free again for delivery, free delivery, and for returns. Free returns with a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up, and they'll refund you all your money. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit to it, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it, right? Best of all, it's made in America. So special offer to you, our listeners, $50 off any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/ricochet and using that coupon code ricochet. Again, that's casper.com/ricochet. Coupon code, of course, Ricochet. And we thank Casper for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast.
You know, I think after this podcast, we should rename the segue and call it the Lilacs. I think this is a new level of broadcast segue.
You're very kind. Yes, well, it's nice when it's 11 o'clock and I've had a little coffee some of the earlier hours. It's just difficult and Rob gets in and I can just see the flywheels spinning up in the air and everything going mad. But no, we would at this point bring in another guest, but we've got a guest in our host. Andrew, of course. You wrote a book recently, which is not a surprise because you turn them out about every 4 weeks. Your latest is The Great Good Thing, A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. Now, did this happen over the course? I guess what I'm asking is this your first Christmas or your second?
this is my 12th Christmas, I think. Maybe 12th? Could be my 13th. I'm not sure. This is the first nonfiction book I've ever written. My wife had to cut it in half because I just threw in every possible thing I could put in there. And she read it. She read the first draft and she said, half of this is the best book you ever wrote. And, so I handed her a pen and let her cut out. Yeah. But this is a story it never really occurred to me would be worth telling. And then slowly it began to dawn on me that even though my journey to faith was very specific, you know, and not everybody is a secular Jew, not everybody comes from my neighborhood, not everybody has the experiences I have, we are all living in a default secular world. We are living in a world where if you start to speak about religious things, people cringe. Yeah, if you say the word Jesus, people just, what they hear is Jesus. You know, they hear this sudden evangelical crazy man talking. And it started to dawn on me that really we're being preached to all the time. We're being preached atheism and secularism all the time. I mean, it's even entered our language. People say, I had an adrenaline rush, or I felt a dopamine high, as if we were just these bags of chemicals with no spirit, with no self, where just the injection of some new chemical from one of our organs changes our entire world. And I just don't think any of that stuff is true. And so I thought it was worth telling a story that is a story of a guy like me who is, I'm a worldling. You know, I love the world. I love politics. I love scotch. I love sex. I love movies. I love all these things. I am not somebody who thinks, oh my God, it's the end of days. Well, you know, oh my God, this sinfulness is dragging us all down to hell. I'm someone who actually enjoys being here. And yet over the course of about 50 years living in a secular world, working in Hollywood, working in New York, working in London, it came to seem to me undeniable that this religion was true. And I wanted to explain that to people. I thought it was a good story.
Baseball game broadcast. That figured into your conversion. How?
It was one of the darkest moments of my life. I lived two lives. Most of you have only known me through the second of those lives, which has been a life truly of increasing joy, of love, of doing work that I love, of having people that I love and friends that I love. The first half of my life was a slow descent into insanity, really, and despair, and suicidal despair. And at the nadir of that descent, I was sitting in a room by myself with a glass of scotch and a pack of cigarettes, listening with a Mets game on in the background. And I was considering killing myself. And I've worked with suicidal people since then. And I know that it gets serious when they start to think about methods. And that's what I was thinking about. How am I going to do this thing? I had a wife I adored. I had a little daughter I adored. And I thought that they would both be better off without me. And I kept thinking to myself, I just don't know how to live. I do not know how to live. I was in such emotional agony. I could not figure out how to go on another day. And on this baseball team, the Mets, there was a player whom I loved, who was Gary Carter, who recently died. And I wrote about him in the Wall Street Journal. He was this cheerful championship, now Hall of Fame catcher, who was a devout Christian and who frequently would say, you know, something embarrassing after a game, like, oh, I got that hit through the blessing of Jesus Christ, and make the reporter would cringe and I would cringe. And after the game, as I was sitting there thinking, I don't know how to live, he was interviewed. And the reporter said to him, how did you manage to beat out that grounder to first base when your knees are so bad from a lifetime of being a catcher? And I expected him to say some Jesus crazy thing that I would have completely ignored. And instead what he said was, sometimes you just have to play in pain. And that was the answer to my question. And I knew the minute I heard it, I thought, that's the answer. That's how you live. Sometimes you just have to play in pain. And I knew I was a pretty tough guy. I knew I could do that. And I knew that there was no answer. And the thing that, when I look back on it, I want to slap that young guy upside the head, because I was literally weeks away from a break, from emotional and artistic breakthroughs that would solve a lot of the problems of my life. So I was sitting there really thinking of ending my life in this dark tunnel when I was steps away from the end of the tunnel. And those words really, I won't say they saved my life, but they certainly put me in the right direction.
Drew, there are some questions that remind me this is just a podcast and we can't really begin to plumb them. This is going to be one of those questions, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You describe yourself, we've had this conversation, before your conversion, you were a secular Jew, but still, you were widely read, you knew the Jewish tradition, you grew up in a Jewish neighborhood where some of your friends must have been serious about their faith. When you became a Christian, do you view it now as turning your back on something, or in one way or another, completing or fulfilling or extending something?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, one of the reasons I think it took me so long to admit that I had become a Christian, to admit to myself that I'd become a Christian, is I did not want anybody to think that I was turning my back on my heritage, that I was trying to fit in. Nobody who knows me would think I was trying to fit in, but I didn't want anybody who didn't know me to think I was trying to fit in, or in any way adopting the kind of replacement theology that once God loved the Jews, but now he had abandoned them because they killed Christ. As I write an entire chapter in my book about the idea that the Jews killed Christ is not even really an English sentence. It sounds like it makes sense, but it doesn't really make any sense. And I write about what that has come to mean to me. I myself, I will just say this. I was raised in the Jewish tradition. I was bar mitzvahed. It made no sense to me because my parents didn't believe in God. So that was why the Jewish tradition made no sense to me. But I can say, speaking only for myself, I never even felt like a Jew until I found Christ. And it was in finding Christ that I suddenly realized what this tradition and what this religion was all about. I'm not saying that's true of anybody, of everybody, but it was certainly true for me.
A lot of men find themselves at the kitchen table with a scotch and a pack of cigarettes at a certain point in their life.
Yes,
no, I'm serious. I'm sure. I mean, I've talked a lot of guys, and there's something that happens. I mean, there's the biological shifts in your own body. I mean, men have a change of life as women do too. You start producing less testosterone. We're told in this culture that testosterone is that absolutely horrible thing that's responsible for all the evils of the world. But there are changes that go on in your body, and all of a sudden you no longer feel as though you have a place in the world anymore. There are a lot of men who go through this, and we don't talk about it very much, do we?
No, I mean, I think that you know, this was very young. I was young, though. I was around 30, so that was not what was happening to me.
Early. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, but I think that it is true that for men, depression, you know, women are just quicker to talk about their feelings, to talk quicker to get help. They're quicker to go to therapists and things like that. I think for me, I just assumed, you know that old Carly Simon song, it's hip to be miserable when you're young and intellectual. I thought that this is the way that artists were. You know, I thought that I didn't realize I was going insane. I thought, oh, I'm just so wise and so deep and so sensitive and so cool that I see the emptiness and despair of the world. It took me a long time to realize that I was just nuts and I was wrong. The world I was seeing was not the world as it was.
Well, again, it's a great story, and I would like to have you back on at some point in the future to talk a little bit more about it. Maybe next year around this time, because there was a piece in our local paper written by somebody saying, as a Jew, I'm sick of Christmas songs.
And let me tell you, as a Christian, I'm sick of Christmas.
Well, I was just going to say that most of the comments in Star Tribune were, you know, yes, welcome to the family here, but being angry at bell ringers outside a Salvation Army is a different thing entirely. And those guys are standing out there in weather that is 3 below without the wind chill. We have got the Arctic blast coming down now. We're looking at the maps. Everything is nothing but midnight blue for a fortnight to come. Horrible. And I'm not a guy who layers. You know, when it's about 5 below, that's when I put on the gloves and the hat to walk the dog. But this is getting into the point where you layer. And so you look around and you think, what do I got? Well, an undershirt is good, but, you know, sometimes you're walking around and it just rides up and it falls out, and then you're a sloppy guy because there's this white undershirt under your nice little sweater. You can avoid that completely with Tommy John's underwear. Now,
unbelievable. From Salvation Army bell ringers to Tommy, that was a segue.
It's a kind of genius.
Unbelievable. Go, James, go.
It's called desperation because I don't know what I'm doing and I'm trying to get to the commercial.
Really, actually, if you think of it, that segue started with suicide. No. That was just the biggest arc I've seen. Oh, go.
Well, here's the thing is that you have to go from suicide to selling underwear, and the sponsor isn't going to like a direct connection, right? So you have to take an antibiotic. What I was talking about, though, is your underwear riding up and falling out. If Tommy John is the name of the company, and it comes from, well, let's talk about Tom Patterson. This man was a medical device salesman confined to a suit, you know, the armor, as he traveled from meeting to meeting. And he couldn't get through the day without his undershirts, his underwear, and his socks bunching up and pinching and sagging because it just, you know, that's just how it is with this stuff. It falls out of place. Seeing a need to improve the thing that is literally the closest thing to any man, his base layers, as we call them, Tom quit his job and commissioned the help of his wife, Erin, a local tailor, and a team of small designers to help create Tommy John. Now, Tom reimagined the fit, the feel, and the function of men's most fundamental layers. and he built and patented new features from scratch. The result? Shirts that stay tucked, trust me. Socks that stay up, trust me, they do. And underwear that keeps everything in place, whichever way a man happens to move. Tommy John is the solution to uncomfortable underwear. It's high-end, high-quality, proprietary fabrics that are just, they're made smart to keep you comfortable in all situations. Now, the collections are made from fabrics that are breathable, lightweight, non-pilling, quick-drying, and warming for cold weather conditions, which matters to me because, as I said, it's Arctic and it's preposterous here. The styles include briefs, square cuts, trunks, boxer briefs, boxer shorts with the added functional events, elements, including a quick-draw horizontal fly for speedy access, shall we say, and a super soft waistband that stays in place without digging. You know how sometimes you just, you take off the underwear, you're happy, and you've just got this elastic imprint around you? You don't have that problem. Roomier contour pouch, and that's no more readjusting as you're walking around your world. Just, trust me, it's just made for men. Undershirts, they're the most comfortable on the planet, period. From form-fitting, not restricting, available with this patented stay-tucked, tapered design. Now, the socks, they're designed to be adjustable from over the calf to mid-calf, and they have a patented Invisigrip. That stay dry technology too, and they come in many stylish designs and patterns to accentuate your individuality. Now, I've got the socks, and what I love about them is true, they stay up. You know, there's nothing worse than feeling them puddle down around your ankles as you're walking, and I love those. And on the cruise, the National Review cruise, where it was hot, 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 I took one of the undershirts, and even in the tropical sun, it was breathable and comfortable. You too can live like this for 20% off your first purchase as well. You go to TommyJohn.com/ricochet and enter the coupon code ricochet at your checkout. Best pair guarantee, by the way. If the underwear is not the best you've ever worn, it's free. It's on them. Free shipping in the continental U.S. for all orders of $50 too. And thanks to Tommy John for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. TommyJohn.com/ricochet. Well, finally, we were talking about John Glenn before, and I'm a kid. I was a space nerd. I really was, and I have all these ornaments that I used to put on the tree of the Mercury and the Gemini and the Apollo and the rest of them. The Apollo was the worst because the legs kept snapping off. And now, of course, if you go to Hallmark, you won't find these anymore. It was a limited run, but you will find Star Wars ornaments. I love the fact that you can buy a Death Star Christmas tree ornament. There's an enormous celestial machine designed to kill billions of people at once, and it's on the Christmas tree. But some people will say that the better the movies got, like Star Wars, Star Trek, the better our visual imagination got, the better computer graphics got, the less somehow we felt the need to go out and explore. Now, Peter has a romance for this American tradition, I know, but we differ on space exploration. I'll just ask Drew, do you think that's the case? Glenn was part of the new frontier. Have we just sort of given up on that now because we've got virtual reality and computer games and it's not as exciting as it was? Or is it really truly that we've just had a mindset shift where we're content to let our robots go out there and do it for a while?
No, I think what happened is really this is what happened was to beat the Russians because we were so shocked by Sputnik. The government took over an enterprise that really is better run by private industry, like almost everything.
And yes!
James
and Rob have been beating me up over
the
go.
No, this is absolutely true. It sucked up all the intelligence, all the information. And so eventually...
Yes, I get that. I understand. And it's great now that we have our own Tony Stark in the form of Elon Musk who wants to go to Mars. That's great. I support all possible efforts to get out there. The fact that European Space Agency, American Space Agency are getting together to put robots on little asteroids and to land them on Titan. I don't care really who's doing it. But let me ask you this. Do you think the private industry would invest in a warp drive or these strange new theoretical drives that NASA's coming up with that really ought not to work, but they are? What would John Glenn say, Peter?
John Glenn. He served four terms in the United States Senate, and I'm pretty sure that that must have made him very acutely conscious of the federal deficit and of quite what you're doing when you tax people to satisfy the whims of people such as NASA scientists and James Lilacs. I don't know what John Glenn used to remember when Glenn was asked, "Were you afraid?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. I was sitting on top of $1 billion worth of equipment produced by people who were the low bidders on government contracts."
You know, I do want to add one thing about John Glenn to go back to what Peter was saying before. When I was a kid, there were three people who represented America to me and represented the kind of man I wanted to be and what it meant to be an American man. And that was John F. Kennedy, Mickey Mantle, the center fielder for the Yankees, and John Glenn. And when you look back at Mickey Mantle, he ultimately was exposed as a drunk and a womanizer. When he was diagnosed with fatal cancer, he came out and said, "Yes, I'm a role model. You should look at me and not do what I did." Of course, John F. Kennedy has been also exposed as a womanizer, a guy who was unfaithful to his wife and, not really the great president we thought he was. But John Glenn remained exactly who we thought he was. Faithful to a wife that he met in his crib, literally in his crib, and heroic, steadfast, honest, true, the real ideal of what it meant to be an American in that era. And I just think that that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I think if you can live 95 years and basically represent that ideal to people, you've done a good thing.
Oddly enough, Ted Williams was in the crib next to him. Of course, Kennedy inspired the nation by saying we will go to the moon and bring a man back in this decade, not because it is easy, but because it is hard, which was also his general motto for his social life. But you've been saying nice things there about Mr. Glenn, Peter, that he learned things in the Senate. But here's the deal. Mike Pence tweeted out a nice statement saying a great American hero has passed. And I read all these tweets from leftists who were angry at Pence for doing that because John Glenn believed in some things that Mike Pence did not. Therefore, Pence had no right to say something nice about him because the personal is the political, don't you know? Because you can't say something decent without these people calling you to task for an inconsistency or what they regard as a horrible stain of hypocrisy. Is he one of the last guys perhaps that the nation as a whole can mourn the passing of? I mean, the little rhetorical termites, of course, spoiling everything for everybody. But do we make guys like that anymore?
I'm leaning towards saying no, that moment in American, that the Cold War, the important thing about John Glenn is that although he became famous as a Cold War hero and as an astronaut, he was a member of the greatest generation. He flew, what was it, more than 50 combat missions in World War II before again becoming a pilot, seeing even more combat missions in Korea. He was a member of the World War II generation. Do we make them like that anymore? Yes, of course we must. Of course we do. But no.
Well, Drew, let me ask you this. Do you think it's a good and hopeful, because you're a hopeful man, and I like that about you, but a good and hopeful definition of America is that while we may cast our eyes around and not see these people in abundance now, that when the situation demands, these people arise, spring out of the soil as though America creates them almost instantaneously. There's something in the character and the quality of this nation that can produce these people when we need them.
There's no question about that. There is no question that the people who responded, and I really should say the guys, the men who responded to the challenge of 9/11, were there. They were out. They went out into the field. They risked their lives. They gave their lives to fight against the threat. This Islamist threat against freedom and democracy. Of course, they're still there. The difference is this: the difference is that in those days, a Democrat and a Republican were really fighting, as Barack Obama once said, over the 50-yard line. John F. Kennedy was a cold warrior. He was killed because he was a cold warrior, because the Soviets hated him. Now, I really do feel that there is a strong leftist strain of people who no longer believe in the American idea. And I think that is the difference, that we are now fighting with an academia, a Hollywood elite, a news elite that do not believe in our founding principles. That wasn't true back then. And I think we're going to have to defeat them because they're wrong. And I think that that's the difference. We have to defeat people in our own country because they no longer believe in the ideals that our country was founded on. That was not true then. That was not true of John F. Kennedy. It wasn't true of the left in those days. It is true of the left now.
You're otherizing them.
That's I am.
That's exterminationist rhetoric right there.
I wish. I only wish.
Well, Peter, any closing thoughts before we run off here? I know that you have something to add before I have the interminable list of sponsors that will immediately make people turn off the podcast because they figure it's done. But it's not. Hold that thought, Peter. Hold it, because I'm going to thank our sponsors first, and then they'll have to listen to what you have to say. We would like to thank everybody for listening, and of course, and for our fine sponsors, Patriot, all, and that would be, of course, Casper, and that would be, of course, our great friends at Away Travel, and Tommy John's. Some of these are new sponsors, and I've used all of these products, and I love them. I love my suitcase, I love my socks, and I love my Casper. I wouldn't say that if I didn't. We don't also advise you to go to the Ricochet store, don't you know, because Christmas is coming, and you can get some fine gifts. Confound a relative of the left-wing persuasion by giving them something with an R on it and tell them it stands for something else. So there's plenty of swag you can buy. We'd like to ask you also if you wouldn't mind going to iTunes. I know, it's a kludgy bloat wreck of a program, but if you do, you can review us, and good reviews help new listeners discover us, which keeps us all going. And, of course, if you're one of those guys and gals who's ponied up yet, you can be one of the 1,500 and keep Ricochet discussing not only this election, but the midterms and the midterms beyond that and the presidential beyond that and into the middle of the century. Do that, please, wouldn't you? All right, Peter, you were going to say something.
I was going to say that I think I'd better save our members. I can just see 20 different comments going up. And Drew had better explain what he means when he says that John Kennedy was killed because he was a cold warrior.
Well, he was killed by a Soviet sympathizer who was afraid that he was isolating Cuba. And the New York Times, on the day he was killed, on the very day, ran a news story saying that that was the truth, and then ran an editorial saying that Kennedy was killed by hatred, essentially, yes, by James Reston, essentially saying that it was Southern bigoted hatred that killed John F. Kennedy. And from that, all the conspiracy theories of the next 50 years spun out. The fact is, he was killed by a communist, and the press was sympathetic to the communists, and so they didn't want to say that, but that's what happened to him.
You know, yes, technically that's true, but when you say when you say communist, I'd rather we just went with Dirty Red Bastard. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to this debate. Thanks, Drew Klavan, for sitting in for Rob Long. Thank you, Peter, of course, as ever, for being one of the founding members and edifices of Ricochet. Thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see everybody in the comments at Ricochet 2.0. Or is it 3.0? Whatever. It's Ricochet.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. I miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space on such a time. Timeless flight. And I think it's gonna be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round and get to find. I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no, no. In fact, it's cold as hell, and there's no one there to raise them. If you did, I
Ricochet. Join the conversation.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around.